Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom to 250,000 demonstrators who packed the mall in Washington. In the coming weeks, you'll hear many excerpts from that speech, but what you probably won't hear is that the march called for a massive federal public works program to provide jobs for the unemployed, and Dr. King spoke of the twin evils of discrimination and economic deprivation. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by looking at the civil rights movement and its demands for racial and economic justice. What was Dr. King's vision of economic justice? What is the vision today? What did jobs and freedom mean back then? And what do jobs and freedom mean today? And how did the activists in the civil rights movement organize around these issues? Today, we are joined by Dr. Dorothy Cotton, a legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King. From 1960 to 1968, Dorothy was education director for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she's author of the book, If Your Back's Not Bent, The Role of Citizenship Education Program in the Civil Rights Movement. And Dorothy joins us from Ithaca, New York. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Eva Patterson, president and founder of the Equal Justice Society, a national organization dedicated to changing the law through progressive legal theory, public policy, and practice. Eva was at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights for 23 years and served as its executive director for 13, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Eva. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And we're joined by Claiborne Carson. He's professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. He's been researching and documenting the life and work of Martin Luther King for nearly three decades. In his latest book, Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Claiborne recounts his evolution from a teenage civil rights activist into a self-described activist scholar. And he joins us from his office in Palo Alto. Hi, Claiborne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. So, you know, in the coming weeks, we're going to hear so many excerpts from the I Have a Dream speech. And I'll be wondering if reporters and the media really focus on the economic justice parts of the speech. Dorothy, it's kind of amazing because you worked very closely with Martin Luther King. You were a very high woman at SCLC. Can you take us back to that time and talk about the message around economic justice?
I'm not sure I can focus so much on economic justice, but Dr. King was looking at, as a matter of fact, the movement incorporated every area where there was injustice in the country. So my particular specific position was actually running the citizenship education program, working and focusing on and with, especially at this time, mostly older African-Americans, but there were other people of other races, cultural expressions with us as well. So Dr. King was really focusing on justice wherever it reared its ugly head. We lived in what I call, at the time, American-style apartheid. So wherever there was injustice, and certainly the economic arena is one where there was great injustice, but it was sort of, it permeated the whole culture. That's not so specific to your question, but it was not just about economic injustice.
What would you add to that, Claiborne? According to the official numbers, back then, 50 years ago, 25 million people were living in poverty.
Well, I think that anyone who looks at the title of the March on Washington, it was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It wasn't a March on Washington for passage of John F. Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill. So I think that the organizers always had in mind that there was a broad agenda that was listed in the call. It was very explicit. And unfortunately, the title of the march has often just been shortened to the March on Washington. And we never quite get a clarity about what it was for. But people at that time were talking about things like the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged, full employment in the economy, things that we still have not achieved now. And one of the reasons why we haven't is again, that misinterpretation of what the movement was about.
Dr. Cotton, it's such a pleasure to be on with you. I heard you being interviewed by Tavis Smiley and Cornel West the day after the Zimmerman verdict, and I was feeling so despondent. And to hear you and your enthusiasm and your years of dedication really lifted me up. Thank you so much. I remember Dr. King saying something to the effect of, it doesn't do any good for you to be able to eat at the lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger. I don't know if that's something that people made up or if he actually said something like that, but I always had a sense that he had a very holistic view of justice, as Dr. Cotton said. It wasn't just about race, it was about making the world better, and I think the economic piece was a huge part of it. But now we've kind of sanitized Dr. King and have made him into something that he really wasn't. But I feel awful saying that in front of you, Dr. Cotton, but I think he was a fiery, revolutionary man who was challenging power, not somebody who spoke in soft tones all the time and didn't threaten anybody.
Claiborne, I've heard that too. Did Dr. King talk about that, that it's not enough to just be able to sit at the counter, but you have to actually afford the food?
Of course, that was part of his agenda. And I think, just being on this program with Eva and Dorothy, I mean, their lives in themselves and their work that they're doing indicates they're living in examples of that broad social agenda that was the movement. I've carried on this campaign for a long time about, let's abandon this term civil rights movement. It's such a limiting term, and it makes it appear that the goal of the movement was simply to pass a piece of legislation. Mm. But if that had been the case, Martin Luther King and Dorothy Cotton and all the rest of us who were in the movement would have retired in 1965, because that was the last major piece of civil rights legislation. So what was Dr. King doing in Chicago in 1966? What was he doing in Memphis in 1968? It wasn't to pass civil rights legislation. So I think we need to perhaps move beyond that term and recognize that, as I said at the beginning, it was not a march on Washington for civil rights legislation. It was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom.
And I've been emphasizing a lot sharing that I've been doing with people about the whole concept of freedom and what freedom actually meant. And as you know, Clay, I was director of the Citizenship Education Program, and I'm really into hopefully helping people understand that we didn't just jump up and have a march. And I sort of get that indication. People think, oh, we had a big march, and that's all the civil rights movement, you know, was about, a big like demonstrations. And I guess I'm struggling, maybe sort of fighting nonviolently, to help, hopefully, to help get into the discourse the fact, you know, what freedom actually means. If it was jobs and freedom, what did the freedom part mean? You're a better economist than I am, Clay. but what did freedom mean? And that's what happened in the Citizenship Education Program, was to help people come to a sense of being free human beings. What did that mean? And there are just so many aspects to that. So if it was jobs and freedom, well, freedom almost incorporates, it seems to me, every aspect of what citizenship means and what this country declared itself to be.
Well, one of the speeches that is often ignored that day was John Lewis's speech earlier in the day before King's. And John Lewis at that time had just been elected chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And one of the phrases that he used in his speech was the demand for one man, one vote. And he said, that's the African cry, that's our cry. And I think what he meant by that is that many of the reasons why people were excluded from the ballot, literacy tests, poll taxes that had been historically used, you know, all these different reasons, were all related to the type of oppression that black people in the South faced. They were subjected to a segregated, inferior educational opportunities, and yet when they went to the polls, they were said, well, because you are supposedly illiterate, that's why we're stopping you from voting. And I think the citizenship education program was designed to try to deal with that deficit, that you could not be truly free if you did not really understand what it meant to be a citizen. And the irony was that those people who went through Dorothy's program understood citizenship better than most white Americans.
And that's exactly, I remember right now some incidents, some discussions, some very interesting focuses of our dialogue around the concept of citizenship. I love to tell the story of one woman who kept complaining about the way black people were treated down in the city hall. And she kept saying, every time I go down there, they will wait on all the white folks first, and I was down there to argue about why my well water didn't get tested. And by the third day in the workshops, when she's telling me that story again for the third time, I asked her, well, why aren't you the city clerk? And I did that to shock people, and indeed it did, trying to help people change their sense of who we were, that we could just be folk who, somebody coined the word awfulizing, talking about how awful some things were, or we could decide that we are going to help our country, this country, be true to what it said on paper. Wonderful your phrase that Martin used a lot. Be true to what it said on paper in the wonderful documents, a part of our founding. And but to change, one thing that Dr. King really emphasized, as Clay, he said, it's a terrible thing when a country, any place, is so structured that one segment of its population is treated as less than other people in that population. But he added, it's even worse when this group of people so treated and discriminated against and treated so badly, when people interpret and take into themselves that definition of themselves. And that was why I had to shock people in my training workshops into coming to a new definition of who we were, of who they were. And because once to claim this interpretation, this definition of what a citizen is, all people born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States, to help people really make that come alive for them was so important into helping to create, and I emphasize, I believe if I were writing, I'd write movement in capital letters, because that helped that spirit, that new reinterpreting, this understanding that we were not going to let other people define who we were as African-American people. We were going to decide ourselves that these wonderful documents, part of our founding documents, meant us, but we had to make them mean us, and that's why we had a movement. Well, a part of the reason we had a movement, because that spirit, the zeitgeist, was upon the land, as a phrase Martin used sometimes. It was upon the people were catching that spirit all over the place, that we are citizens, and everything accruing to a citizen will be ours, and we are going to ensure that that is so. I hope that makes some point. I'm not rather rambling.
No, it's great. That's Dr. Dorothy Cotton. She's a legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King. Eva Patterson is president and founder of the Equal Justice Society, and Claiborne Carson is professor of history at Stanford and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. That was its official title, although the jobs and freedom part we don't hear very much about today. And we're talking about, what were the demands back then when you're talking about economic justice? What were the realities people were facing back then? What are we facing today? How far have we come? What's changed? What hasn't changed? And we'd love to hear from you. We did a show last week about the speech, and we got so many great calls from those of you who remembered it and had really great memories about how it affected you. So what do you think about the economic aspect of it, the jobs and freedom aspect of it? And when you look at how things have or haven't changed, what really strikes you? What do you think the message around economic justice should be today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Claiborne or Eva, the march called for a massive federal public works program to provide jobs for the unemployed. Can you talk about some of the specific demands? Eva, do you want to go first?
I'll come at it from a legal perspective, because the year after the March on Washington, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and part of that was Title VII, which prohibited discrimination in employment, and that opened up a lot of jobs. There were all kinds of cases brought in the South that threw out ridiculous requirements for jobs, like to be an entry-level person, you had to have a physics degree. That's obviously hyperbolic, but you had to have overqualification for very easy jobs, but that was a way to keep Black people, women, Latinos, Asian Americans out of jobs. So that was one of the ways and one of the tools that lawyers were given. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was created in order to make sure that employment opportunities were made, that the level playing ground occurred for employment opportunities. So I come at this more from the legal point of view. This unleashed lawyers across the country suing people, desegregating private employment. What was interesting is that public employment was not covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was amended a few years later, and then that opened up public employment to people of color as well. So that's one strand of it. I think probably Dr. Cotton and Dr. Carson will know other examples.
Well, one of the things, Eva, that I'm sure you're aware of is that the largest category of beneficiaries of the 1964 Civil Rights Act in terms of employment were women.
Indeed.
Not African-Americans.
That's right.
And that's another aspect of how this movement has affected people and benefited people who do not understand their indebtedness to what Martin Luther King symbolized.
And before we talk about other demands, Eva, what was the fallout from those changes? I mean, what did we see after those laws changed and lawyers filed lawsuits?
Well, let me give you an example in San Francisco. In San Francisco, the first Black firefighter was hired in 1955. His name was Earl Gage. When he went around to substitute for different firefighters, they would call up their friends and say, a Black man's in your bed. And one person came and flipped him out of his bed. So Earl Gage, when he went to different firehouses, had to take his own mattress.
Wow.
This is in San Francisco. In 1984, there were no women in the fire department. They weren't even allowed to apply to be firefighters. Black men were treated very abysmally. When some Black men walked into fire stations in San Francisco, guerrilla noises were made. They would put eggs in the shoes of the firefighters. And when you're running to a fire and you have an egg in your shoe, that's going to harm you. One firefighter had the belt that holds him onto the back of the fire engine sawed through. So when he whipped around a corner, he flew off the truck, was lying in the street. The other firefighters, he was Black. The other firefighters claimed they didn't see him. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964 allowed us to go in, get women in the department. There is now a woman chief. One of our clients was the first Black chief, Bob Demons. It was like he was one of the main plaintiffs in the case. It was like Nelson Mandela becoming the president of South Africa. We got close to $1 million in damages for Black firefighters who had been the victims of harassment. There are women officers. There are Latinos, Asian Americans. This is something I want to talk about, something that Clay talked about. We think of discrimination just affecting maybe Latinos and African Americans, but the height requirements kept Asian Americans out of positions in the fire department. Also, stereotypes about Asian Americans were very negative to them in that it was thought, well, Asian Americans can't be leaders. In San Francisco, when we filed the case in 83, there were no Asian American officers in the fire department. Now they're all throughout the fire department. So Clay is exactly right. the civil rights movement helped many people. Dr. Cotton's exactly right. And I was writing down everything you said. You were not rambling, my sister. You were lifting my spirits. The whole idea of not letting the dominant culture define how you see yourself. And now women can see themselves as firefighters. And so the advocacy and the training that you did, Dr. Cotton, is still being relevant today. So that's, I'm a lawyer, so I kind of know that angle of things. But the law helped open things up.
Right. And Dorothy, do you want to jump in?
No, well, I'm agreeing with everything that, you know, that we just heard. I think we could write a book just simply focusing on just the arenas, you know, the areas where all the folk in the, shall I say, racial or cultural groups that you have listed, you know, Latinos, African-Americans, Native Americans, people were kept out of a lot of, you know, a good number of areas of employment because of our, I call it American-style apartheid. So I agree with what everything that was just analyzed so beautifully.
Well, let's hear from a listener before we go to break. Let's go to Clark in San Francisco. Hi, Clark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show. I just wanted to ask one question. I was kind of inspired by what was being said, and I wondered what America would look like if there were a Violence Against Men Act and No Violence Against Women Act, and if affirmative action said males black and white instead of females Asians and Hispanics, and if somebody with a fake ID could steal a Harvard Law School graduate job. That's it. That's what was on my mind. Thanks a lot.
Can you focus his question? Oh,
thank you, sister.
Are you still there, Clark? I had a hard time understanding what you meant, actually.
It felt like it was just hostile to where we were coming from, because affirmative action is a remedy for underrepresentation of women and people of color, and there's very little voter fraud. So it feels like he's coming from the what are you people complaining about school?
I was a little unclear, but I think we just lost Clark. Sorry about that.
I need to say something that really has nothing to do with any specific question that has been raised, and that is this terminology, people of color. I'm beginning to make some notes and to really focus, get more and more specific on what I think I'm seeing with what we do to a segment of the population once we get them in a category. Once you get people in a particular category, some weird things happen. Now, no, you haven't asked that, but every time I hear people say people of color, which to me, and I think Dr. King referred to such used such a phrase, but he also was a learner, and he would move on from, we could argue with him about some things, and, you know, lovingly argue with him, but of course when he really had something to say, we also, you know, shut up and listen to him too. But I'm just so conscious of these categories into which we put people and what it does to keep a lot of the negative stuff going in the culture. I don't know if that makes any point for anyone, but I just sort of cringe when I hear people of color.
Well, that's interesting. I'd love to have you elaborate on that after the break. And I do also want to talk about something that Eva brought up earlier, and that is that this speech was really for everyone. And when you do hear about it in the media, it's sort of, I have a dream for blacks or people of color, as you said, Dorothy. So we'll talk about what that means exactly and what gets lost as a result. Today, we're joined by Dr. Dorothy Cotton, a legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Dr. King. Eva Patterson is president of the Equal Justice Society. Claiborne Carson is director of the MLK Junior Research and Education Institute. We'd love to hear from you. What did freedom and jobs mean back then, and what do they mean today? What about economic justice today? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW, your call with Rose Aguilar. To join in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also write, if you'd prefer, send us an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or simply post a message at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how the U.S. regulates imported food, which now accounts for about 15% of what we eat. What do you want to know about where your food comes from and how it's processed? That's tomorrow. And then Thursday, we'll talk about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. There's so much happening with Yemen, Israel, Palestine, Iran, Syria. We'll talk about what the U.S. and their what is the policy changes, if any, in the Middle East. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we're going to talk about Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement on drug policy. So be sure to look out for news of that and send us some good stories for Friday's show. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. In the coming weeks, you'll hear many excerpts from the I Have a Dream speech, and we will be watching to see if media talk about the massive federal public works program. There was a call for that. Dr. King spoke of the, quote, twin evils of discrimination and economic deprivation. So what did freedom and jobs mean back then? What does it mean today? How far have we come? Back then, according to the official numbers, 25 million people lived in poverty. Today, it's 46 million. So what are your thoughts on this? And what changes do we still need to see? What should the message be today? 866-798-8255. And of course, if you have any questions for our trailblazing activists about what they remember from that time, we'd love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Claiborne Carson is professor of history at Stanford and director of the MLK Junior Research and Education Institute. Eva Patterson is president of the Equal Justice Society. Dr. Dorothy Cotton is a legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King. Eva, what are your thoughts about what Dorothy just said about the term people of color?
It's interesting. I never want to disagree with a legendary person. I'm sitting here going, oh, no, I'm saying something she doesn't like. But here's my kind of history about this. When I was involved in the fire department case, I was working with a women's law firm that I happen to be the chair of the board, Equal Rights Advocates. And there was a woman named Margie Fujiki, and she's the first person I ever heard say the word people of color. And I didn't understand what was happening, but as I've gone over the years, I've thought about it this way. We used to be called kind of as a group minorities, and the notion of minorities defines us kind of as in opposition to the majority. So the sense was not to call ourselves a term that was negative, but to embrace the notion people of color. I love the term, but I very much want to hear why Dr. Cotton thinks it's not a good term, because I respect and admire you a lot. So I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Let me tell you that I know that this is something that's just unfolding. Take that seriously in me now, that I'm beginning to just look at it. We have been called, I'm going to say African-Americans at this point. We have been called six or seven things. We were Negro. We were, Clay, you may know the order in which they go, but Negro, Black, African-American, Afro-American.
And the NAACP was called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
And colored people, right. We've been called, six or seven things, and we even contributed to, James Brown used to sing a song, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And but to have been called six or seven, designated by six or seven categories, and then looking at now, I'm just beginning to do a little research on that. What happens once we're in those categories? I think it warrants some research, and I want to, Clay, maybe as you help me get started on the book that I did do, Clay, maybe you can have some dialogue. I'd love to do that, either with you, hang out there at Stanford, and look at all those categories, and not just us, quote-unquote, people of color, but other people that get put in a category. But again, relative to jobs, I also want to look at what are the jobs today as we look at the economic arena. Mm-hmm. Where are the jobs? But what are the jobs? You know, my dad could go get a job and take care of his family, though in a sad kind of way early on, but he could go get a job in a factory anywhere, mm-hmm, where there was a factory that needed what he had to offer. But we have to look at what and where are the jobs today? Can you just walk out? I mean, the whole economic arena, and I think that someone has already alluded to this, we have to look at what do we need to have people prepare for the kinds of jobs that are available, that are necessary, that are being created today, rather than just saying, you know, we can't get a job. The jobs you can't do as my grandmother did, work in a field all day picking cotton. And those jobs don't exist anymore. They've got machines to do that. And I'm sure, Clay, you can probably, all of you, say much more about that, the nature of employment. For me, it would be hard for me to get a job in a lot of places because when I look at all this technology, and I've got to learn at this stage of my life, all this machinery, this technology, I guess I'd better look for become just right or something. Does that make any point for anyone?
Yes,
it does. And I'd like to build on that, because part of what's going on as I compare 1963 to the current day is a couple of things are very different. You had a Congress where you actually could get things passed. You could get Civil Rights Act passed and jobs bills passed. You had a nation that wasn't enthralled to multinational corporations who will take a lot of jobs into other countries. You didn't have the Koch brothers and Alec trying to destabilize the union movement so that people couldn't get good jobs. You didn't have money as such a powerful player in our political situation, where very rich people are able to dominate the politics. You didn't have a Citizens United case that allowed all this money to flow in. So I often wonder what Dr. King would think if he were here today. Things were bad then, but things are bad now. But I also don't want to get into awfulizing. I wrote that down, Dr. Cotton, because there are people fighting to struggle to make things better, but the dynamics are really very different today.
I think Eva's kind of put your finger on a lot of the issues that are still with us today that Dr. King would be very much concerned about. And I think one measure of where we haven't come since the 1960s is that when Dr. King was assassinated in 1968, it was the national policy of the United States to eliminate poverty.
Yes,
now,
yes,
if any politician ran for office on that platform, I'm going to eliminate poverty, they would probably be disqualified from serious consideration for higher office.
You're right.
So I think that that's come from being a goal that we should be working toward. You know, it might be a hard goal to reach, but it certainly should be on the political agenda. And yet you heard in the last presidential campaign almost no mention of poverty as an issue to be addressed.
Right.
And Clay, do you agree that we are a part of that analysis has to include what the jobs are now?
Of course. And I think that now we are in a, you know, one of the things that Dr. King would not be surprised about was the concept of globalization.
Mm-hmm.
He talked often about the interdependence of people throughout the world. And now we've kind of arrived in the world that he envisioned, but many of us are not prepared for it. Many of us, you know, when kids are in school, you know, that it's not that Black kids or white kids in school are competing with each other. They're competing with people around the world for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that consciousness, that awareness that that we live in a global economy and we're not going back to another kind of economy.
On one list of, I think someone referred to, I thought about, and don't leave out the people, millionaires, who bank their money overseas somewhere so they don't have to pay taxes.
Or General Electric.
Social Security. I won't call any names. That would be too political if I said a presidential candidate.
You can be political on this show, Dorothy.
Go ahead on, Doctor.
That is Dr. Dorothy Cotton. She's a legendary legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King from 1960 to 68. Dorothy was education director for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She's author of If Your Back's Not Bent, The Role of the Citizenship Education Program in the Civil Rights Movement. Eva Patterson is president and founder of the Equal Justice Society. They're a national organization dedicated to changing the law through progressive legal theory. And I just want to mention, they're going to commemorate the march at an event called Everyday People, August 28th from 6 o'clock on at the Oakland Museum. A number of incredible artists will be there, and we'll put a link to this event right after the show. Hope you can make it.
And I should mention that Palo Alto and the Martin Luther King Institute will have a major commemoration at City Hall in Palo Alto on the 26th.
Great.
Oh, wow. I got to get myself out there.
And that's Claiborne Carson, professor of history at Stanford and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. His latest book is Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And if you'd like to join us, we'll have a line open in a few minutes, 866-798-8255, on this question of jobs, freedom, and economic justice. How far have we come? I'm going to talk about this survey that just came out by the Associated Press that found 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least part of their lives. Again, 4 out of 5. This is a massive number. So what are your thoughts on that? And what should the message be today? How do you get politicians to talk about poverty and economic justice? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
When I hear this discussion, there's something that happened in the 1960s in the civil rights movement that is kind of shockingly absent right now in this talk. And that's this. In the 60s, what was happening was a huge amount of voter registration and local community organizing and local community education. I mean, most notably, you had the Mississippi Freedom Summer, where, you know, thousands of kids from all over the country went down and registered people to vote and created the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And right now, you know, as has just been said, our Congress is a lot worse than it was then.
Could I just interject?
Sure, Claiborne.
Claiborne
wanted to jump in on a point you made.
I don't think Brian is quite listening to what Dorothy Cotton is saying. She helped register those voters. She helped register Fannie Lou Hamer. She is the one who is responsible. The citizenship education program was designed to help people vote. That was the point. So I think that we shouldn't let that go by as if that's that we're avoiding that topic. I think you need to understand that it wasn't just people knocking on doors asking people to vote. It was people being trained to become citizens, and that's a much more deeper-rooted activity that had an impact. Now there are more black elected officials in the Deep South than any other part of the nation. Of course, that's partly because there's more black people in those areas. But that's the result of the work that people like Dorothy Cotton did.
Okay, good. Well, that's great, but I'm talking about the march now. Is there going to be training for people to be educated to go back to their home and register new voters? Because if we register all the poor and people of color or minority voters, especially if you register all the poor voters, the Republicans are just going to be out of Congress in half of their districts. Is there any training now at this march?
I really got to jump in on that, because every time I'm in, I don't know, a workshop or wherever, any gathering, and people raise a question like, yeah, why isn't somebody doing? Where is the training? But we always look outside of ourselves. There are venues in which such training would be very welcome, but people can also create, as the people that I named, like Fannie Lou Hamer, like Topsy Eubanks in Tennessee, like a whole bunch of folks who decided, Esau Jenkins, who started this training program on his bus. A white man killed a young black boy because the boy ran over his dog. Actually, the dog ran in front of the man's truck. But this white guy killed him on John's Island and in South Carolina. And Esau Jenkins, who had a third grade mind, but a PhD, he had a third grade great education, but a PhD mind. That's what Septimus Clark said about him, because this man said, the reason you all didn't respond to this white man killing this black boy for this accident with his dog was because you have no political power. That's really how the citizenship education program got started, that Esau Jenkins started helping people understand why they must have political power and vote. Esau, like I said, was probably third grade, but he had his own little business going there in South Carolina. But we always look outside of ourselves. You know, Martin Luther King isn't coming back. But we can look at what we learned during the area in which he gave leadership. But also, I want to emphasize, Martin Luther King did not start the civil rights movement, but he emerged out of what ordinary people were doing. Maybe everybody's ordinary. But he emerged out of what they had to really, Clay, wouldn't you agree that they had to kind of pressure him in Montgomery, Alabama to become head of the Montgomery Improvement Association?
I would certainly agree with that. But just getting back to Brian's point, I think that all of us would agree that we need to go out and not only register more people to vote, but also train people to be active citizens. That is, really believe in that notion that they can help determine their own destiny.
It matters.
Because that is something that's crucially important. But I think that where I disagree with Brian is that there are millions of people out there doing it.
Yes, there are.
The fact that in the last election, in many parts of the country, the proportion of black voters was higher than the proportion of white voters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's still way too low. We should have people voting at the rates they do in many other countries in the world. But part of that is because we have laws that make it difficult for people to vote. We should have a 24-hour or a weekend so that people do not have to miss work. We should have laws that make it possible for people to vote without waiting hours in line. I've never waited in Palo Alto more than 5 minutes to vote.
Mm-hmm.
There are areas in this country where you have to wait 2 and 3 hours, and people are getting off from work and having to wait, and the polls are officially closed by the time they get into the voting booth. Now, that is just wrong, and that is designed to suppress
the vote. We had to fight against the fact, and we knew it was by design, that the places where black folk would go to register to vote, they were intentionally closed by the time black folk left their job. Mm. And, of course, we could designate. We knew where the black jobs were, and it was intentional. We discovered that in a good number of places, that the places were closed, so you can't register because the registration places closed.
But let's look at what's going on. I'm sorry.
Somebody's got to act. We have to act on that.
Well, let's look at what's going on now after this horrible Shelby County Supreme Court case, where the state of Texas, 2 hours after that decision, started enacting more restrictive voting requirements and having the necessity for voter ID. So it's not just that we don't make voting convenient. The GOP is now doing everything it can to thwart poor people, older people, black folks from voting, not allowing voting on Sundays. So these folks know what's going on. This is the new poll tax. But I would totally endorse what Dorothy and Clay said. I know that folks, NAACP and other people, have done massive voter registration. So people are out there.
And I also want to add, this isn't getting much media attention, but the Dream Defenders, college students in Florida, have been in the Capitol for the past 28 days, 24/7. This is after the Trayvon Martin ruling came down. And their goal is to register 61,000 new voters to oust Republican Governor Rick Scott. So these are all college students, and they're going to school in a couple of weeks. And they said, even when we go to school, we're going to continue. They're not calling it an occupation, but they are in the Capitol 24/7. So there's a lot going on, but we're not hearing about a lot of it.
I watched The Daily Show last night, and they were talking about people in Australia where you have to vote. It's required that you vote. If you do not vote, you get fined. Now, I think the powers that be in this country would not like that, because all the people that Brian was talking about would come to the polls and maybe throw the bad folks out.
Well, that was actually Lawrence. So thank you for...
Oh, Lawrence.
Yeah,
sorry, Lawrence.
Thank you for calling in, Lawrence. That is Eva Patterson, founder of the Equal Justice Society. Claiborne Carson is director of the MLK Jr. Research and Education Institute. Dr. Dorothy Cotton is a legendary activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King. And we've got, wow, the show's flown by, just about 5 or 7 minutes left. And I want to ask you all, you know, thinking about what you learned from the march and the message on jobs and freedom back then, what should the message be today? Because going back to this AP survey that 4 out of 5 Americans face poverty in their lifetimes, it found that while poverty rates for Blacks and Latinos are nearly 3 times higher today by absolute numbers, the predominant face of the poor is white. More than 19 million whites fall below the poverty line of about $23,000 a year for a family of four, accounting for more than 41% of the nation's poor, nearly double the number of poor Blacks. So how do you get, what should the message be, and how do you reach such a, I mean, we're talking about so many people here. I mean, these are massive numbers. What do you think, Eva?
I want to circle back to something Dr. Cotton said. She talked about the kind of global view that Dr. King had. It's very interesting to me that this week President Obama gave Bayard Rustin the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And one of the things that I've taken from Bayard Rustin's analysis is something that he called the Grand Coalition. And that is, if just the poverty people are in one group, the race people are in another group, the environmental are in another silo, the LGBT folks are in another silo, and we're all working at separate tables, we're not going to be very effective. I think what we have to do, and to me this is something that Dr. King was about, was to look at the global vision that we're trying to move forward and have each other's back. So we find out who's working on poverty and the minimum wage and have their back. We don't have much time left. I could talk more, but I'll stop.
Well, actually, that's a good point, because last week we had Gary Young on, who wrote a new book about the speech. And he said one of the main differences, and something we really need to talk about, is back then you had one major issue, which was segregation. So everybody could really focus on that issue. But now when you look at like Trayvon Martin, there are subsets of issues. So that's the problem, is that there's just so much. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Dorothy?
But it's so much, but it's in a way it's all connected. It sort of flows together, because we could fill pages just listing how, I'll just say racial segregation at this point, how it manifested itself in what arenas. But all when work started happening in all of these various arenas, a powerful change emerged. And also, I think we really need to remember that there were a lot of good number of organizations, you know, the Congress of Racial Equality, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. There were a lot of organizations working from the same vision. Would you agree with that, Clay? There were a lot of people who, when we say the movement, to me, I get there's a very large picture that flows in front of me.
Exactly, and I think that that's what we need now. We need a freedom and social justice and peace movement that understands these interconnections. That's what made Dr. King so unique as a leader, is that he had that global historical vision of how these movements, the anti-colonial movement, the anti-apartheid movement, but also the labor movement, and all of these movements were interconnected. Because they were all about the dispossessed of the world claiming their rightful share of every nation's future and the world's future. And that's what it's really about, is that if you are one of those many people of all races who kind of look to the future and say, I don't have any control over that. That it's just something that's going to happen to me, and I have nothing, you know, there are more powerful people who are going to determine my destiny. I mean, if that statement applies to you out there listening, then you need to get in the movement, because that is not what democracy is supposed to be about. Vincent Harding, another one of our friends, has often said that we need courses on the advanced study of democracy. You know, what does it mean? I don't think the United States was even a democratic nation until the 1960s, because how can you have a democratic nation when you're excluding many of your citizens?
Right.
But we're an early experiment in democracy. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to build a multiracial, multicultural democracy that works. If you look at us now, we're saying it's not working very well. Mm. So I think that that is a call for us to get involved in a movement to create a truly democratic society.
Clay, you may not have meant this, but I think included this, but I think maybe you did. This is why I'm concerned about the categorization, if that's a word, how we get people in various categories, and then, you know, we...
Well, I think one of the things that has happened since the 1960s is that there's still categories, but there's a lot of people who cross categories.
Yes, indeed.
And I think that the largest group of the fastest growing category is multi. and I think that is a product of the 1960s, and it points to the fact that we don't have a separate destiny. The United States does not have a separate destiny from the rest of the world. You know, black people and white people don't have separate destinies from the rest of the world. We are interconnected. That was King's basic message.
It's starting to be revealed to us now, but I think it's really in its infancy.
Yeah, yeah. We're still in the learning process of what it means to be democratic.
Well, Martin said, "How we will either learn to live together on this planet, or
or we will perish."
What he really said, we will learn to live together as brothers and sisters on this planet. I said that somewhere recently, last week, and somebody said, well, do you know how brothers and sisters fight all the time?
But they make up at the end.
Well, and unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll leave it there. Thank you all so much. It's really been an honor. Dr. Dorothy Cotton is a legendary civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King. Dorothy, I loved hearing you on Tavis and or Smiley and West. You didn't let them get a word in edgewise, which rarely happens. That was great. Eva Patterson is president of the Equal Justice Society, and Claiborne Carson is professor at Stanford and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How can we make imported food safer? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how the U.S. regulates imported food, which now accounts for about 15% of what we eat. Due to a recent spike in illnesses from contaminated food imports, the Obama administration has proposed tightening up regulations through the Food Safety Modernization Act. So what do you want to know about where your food comes from and how it's processed? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.